Ms. Kichner, Mr. Payne, you're open.
May I please the court? Ms. Kichner, I will be presenting our argument regarding our point of error. Wolfville will argue on the respondent's cross point and their point of error. Okay. This case is a dispute arising out of serious
construction. Could you talk a little louder, please?
Yes, I'll do my best. This is a dispute arising out of a series of construction contracts. The plaintiffs were to build a series of multifamily residences which were owned by the defendant. Wayne was owned by the defendant. So Wayne was conveyed to Johnson Development Incorporated as part of the contract between the parties. After plaintiffs filed a suit to collect on the contract, a receiver was appointed who sold the balance of the property. The sale was confirmed. The defendant's counterclaim, trial was passed to the jury. Court entered judgment for the plaintiff disregarding the jury's answer to four special issues. Court of Civil Appeals reversed, holding that the plaintiff failed to lay a proper predicate for their proof of damages and demanded for a new trial. This proof was summary of the record of Johnson Development Incorporated relating to the project. The summary was oral and presented by the testimony of the plaintiff's chief accountant, Ray Carswell. Now, this court's decision, the Black Lake Pipeline Company case, citing the brief, the party, this three-part test for summary of records. It must be shown that the records were voluminous, that the underlying records were admissible, and that the records were made available to opposing counsel. Now, there's no real question that two parts of the Black Lake test were met. The records were voluminous. Carswell estimated that there were 6 or 7 boxes, and ultimately 8 boxes were brought into the courtroom. They were accessible to the defendants. Their lawyers reviewed them 4 separate times before trial, twice in 6 months before trial. The issue then is whether the underlying records were properly qualified in the Business Records Act, Article 3737E, and in particular, whether the personal knowledge requirements of that text were met. The records which Carswell summarized included invoices from subcontractors and material names, which we discussed, and the records of payment of plaintiffs, who they paid, how much they paid, and the plaintiff's journal, which showed the expenses charged to this project and others. Okay. Now, these invoices, by the time they were paid, and they're part of the plaintiff's business records, they were not just requests for payment, bills from subcontractors or material. As Leon Morris, construction superintendent, and Mr. Duncan himself testified, each invoice bears a notation by one of the plaintiff's employees with personal knowledge that the work was done, the invoice was paid, and that payment should be charged to a particular job. Those are the records. Now, the issue is personal knowledge. At trial in the Court of Civil Appeals, the defendants argued that the qualifying witness Ray Carswell had to have personal knowledge that the work was done, etc., etc. This is contrary to the express wording of Section 2 of the statute. Section 2 simply says that the identity and mode of preparation of the memorandum or record, in accordance with provisions of paragraph 1, may be proved by the testimony of the infant, custodian, or other qualified witness, even though he may not have personal knowledge as to the various items of content of such memorandum or record. court followed that section in the University of Savings versus Security Lumber case, cited in brief. Okay, two cases have dealt with personal knowledge requirement as it relates to subcontractors' invoices in construction cases. These cases are not cited in the brief. One is North Harris County Junior College District versus Fleetwood Construction, 604 Southwest 2nd, 247. That's 1980 decision out of the 14th District. Houston.
What was that side again, John?
604, 247. This court, NRE. In that case, the court pointed out that the business records introduced by the contractor to support its claim did not all originate in its offices, nor were they all prepared by its personnel. The court does say, however, that there is evidence, however, that the records were transmitted to Fleetwood employees, a contractor employee, who had personal knowledge of the events reported sufficient to ascertain the veracity of information contained therein. The court held that the records were qualified under 3737E. Another case, out of Dallas, Hanson Southwest Corporation versus Dalmat Construction Company, 554 Southwest 2nd, 712, 1977, NRE. The court said that in this case, facts were different. The comptroller who prepared the record, was his personal knowledge was limited to the fact that the various subcontractors billed the contractor for the labor and material. He had no independent knowledge that the work was done or that the materials were received. But the court noted, I think the key to its decision in denying the admissibility of the records was that he was not furnished that information by employees of Dalmat when he prepared the record. And that is what stems the case amount. The record is discussed in some detail in our application for writ of error, discussing the evidence showing that there was personal knowledge by the plaintiff's employee. Mr. Carswell testified that the people who make the entries have personal knowledge, and that they approved, people with personal knowledge approved the invoices for payment. Mr. Morris, the superintendent, said he had personal knowledge of everything that went on out there at the project and that every invoice went across his desk. What's more, every invoice was initially for payment. Mr. Duncan went into some detail outlining the system for approving invoices. When an invoice is received, he opens the letter, he sends the invoice over to the bookkeeping department, who sends the invoice over to the job superintendent or some other responsible employee whose job it is to see that the invoice is proper for payment, that the work was done. He then approves for payment and returns to bookkeeping to write the check. So, Court of Civil Appeals was incorrect when it stated that none of the plaintiff's employees had personal knowledge that the work was done. Carswell's own personal knowledge, or lack of it, was irrelevant because the records themselves were prepared by plaintiff's employees with personal knowledge or included information transmitted from employees of plaintiffs with personal knowledge. Again, the Court of Civil Appeals missed the point when it said that invoices were prepared by the subcontractors and not by the plaintiff's employees. By the time they became part of our business records, they had plenty of notations on them to show that the work was done and invoices with proper for payment. That became our memoranda, incorporated the price and itemization information in the original invoice.
Now, what actual record is it that is in question? Is it the invoices that were submitted to the builder, or the records that the builder prepared from the invoices?
Well, all these records are involved, Your Honor.
I'm talking about the one to which the 3737E objection was sustained.
They were just talking about the contractor's invoices. The other records were pretty well ignored by the Senate Council, and really by the Court of Civil Appeals. These other records, the records of payment, checks, journals, those were pretty well overlooked.
Were they offered into evidence?
Well, they were part of the records summarized by Mr. Carswell. And the records could be clearer if that was part of the records to be summarized, but they were, and I think there's enough to show that in the records.
It's your contention there was enough there without these original invoices to prove up your case, or that you need the original invoices?
I think there's enough in there without it.
And you rely on your summary for that?
Summary
supported by these voluminous records?
The summary supported by the records of payment, the journal entries, and that summary is also summarizing the contractor's invoices too. To some extent, of course, it's duplicative. The invoices come in, they're part of the records too. The records of payment, of course, the payment of these invoices and Duncan's own employees. It might help at this point to show how the system could correct itself. One invoice was introduced at trial at Senate Exhibit 7, the copy of the invoice. It was initially charged to the project erroneously. This invoice is the source of the defendant's assertion in their reply to our application that Leon Morris, the construction superintendent, supposedly admitted that the records were erroneous. What he said was that if an invoice from contractor's construction company for an asphalt parking lot had been charged to this project, then the records would be erroneous. Now, this BX7 was introduced by the defendant. It showed a number on it for this project and subcategory. The defendant introduced it attempting to impeach Mr. Carswell. But when they asked Mr. Carswell about it, he told them that charge had been made, but it had been corrected within 1 or 2 months after the error had been made, a long time before trial, and it was not included in his summary. It was not one of the items he summarized as being chargeable to the defendant. No system is perfect, but the defendant inspected the records many times, 4 times prior to trial, made copies of portions of it, but at trial they could not impeach the accurateness of the records. Okay. We've demonstrated that claims laid a proper predicate under the Business Records Act for the admissibility of all these records. At the very least, it ought to be clear that there was enough evidence there for the support of the trial court's implied finding of personal knowledge. I particularly refer the court to the judge's comment, page 172 of the Statement of Facts, where he noted that there was evidence of personal knowledge by the plaintiff's employee. This is especially significant since the defendant's only objection at that time was that Carswell himself had no personal knowledge of the work done. In any case, the defendant made an unlimited offer of substantial identical evidence as Card will testify to. That's Defendant's Exhibit 5. Now they try to dismiss it as hearsay, even though they introduced it. But they offered it into evidence. And offered by them, it's admissible as admission.
Tell me about that Exhibit 5. What did it show?
Well, it showed, it broke down the items, various categories of charges to the various buildings. The building number one category, and building number two and three were a separate category together. It broke it down and just showed what the costs were. Materials, subcontractors, labor, overhead, and profit. And it tallied identically, I believe, with what Mr. Cardwell testified to. In fact, it was a summary he testified from, I believe. They made an unlimited offer of it. We could not have kept it out if we had made an objection to it. It was admissible. It's independent evidence of the fact which Cardwell proved, and it weighs any objection they might have had to any prejudice which might have been caused by the introduction of hearsay. So, at this point, unless y'all have any questions, I'll yield to Ms. Borg. Thank you.
I might object at this point. The project we're talking about, or the construction that we're talking about, was on a tract of land of the construction of five separate condominium buildings. And the last two buildings, that were buildings two and three, as I'll refer to them here, were built and completed. Building one was built and completed, and the last agreement between these parties called for a cost-plus arrangement. That is, cost plus overhead plus a percentage for profit. In that connection, one of the cross points raised in the defendant's response to our application for writ was an assertion that the damages were incorrectly calculated by the district court in entering its final judgment. There were three subheadings under that cross point, one of which related to the 6% calculation. I would have to admit that the one fair construction of the contract the parties were operating under would be that the standard would be construction clause plus overhead plus 6% of construction cost. There was testimony in the record that the normal way of handling this by plaintiffs was construction cost plus overhead and 6% of the total. Now, with respect to these two buildings, the latter two buildings that were built, this totals to a difference in calculation of about $3,900, which we feel really insignificant in the overall scope of this case. As I say, there was testimony that the method used by the district court in calculating this damage was the normal way it was handled on a cost-plus job by these plaintiffs. The other subdivision of the damage complaint related to sales of units in the first building that was constructed. The first building constructed was completed somewhere in October of 1976. And it was done under an arrangement where plaintiffs agreed to construct only one building. Although these defendants apparently had visions of ultimately constructing five buildings on this property. But the written agreement between them involved only the construction of one building. The building, as I've indicated, was completed somewhere in October of 1976, and it, for all practical purposes, sat there until August of 1977, when the last agreement was entered into between these parties. The units, when the last agreement, or last written agreement, was entered into between these parties, the plaintiffs began efforts to market the units in building number one. And those units were marketed. There was testimony by Mr. Ray Carzo, the chief accountant for the plaintiff, that the net proceeds derived from the sale of those units, which the plaintiff is admittedly accountable for, was $195,569, the amount used by the district court in writing its judgment. During the course of the trial, defendants produced and introduced over objection closing statements from the sales of the various units, which had a different figure, and it is this figure which the jury answered in response to the special issue, number 8, inquiring as to the amount of the sale proceeds. Now, when the jury took these closing statements and added up its answer to special issue number 8, it in essence took the gross sale price, which appears on line 401 on each one of these closing statements. No account was taken as to the closing costs paid at the time the sale was consummated. The net figure on the closing statement was something like $206,900, gross figure something like $209,000. The net figures on these closing statements appear on line 603 of each of the closing statements. Again, the issue that was submitted asked, what were the sale figures? We feel that the district court properly disregarded the jury's answer to that issue in the manner in which it was phrased and in the manner in which the jury responded to it. I might also add that with respect to the closing statement, I believe Mr. Duncan, the plaintiff, was questioned extensively with regard to the closing statement, and he indicated that Mr. Carswell's figures were correct, notwithstanding different figures on the closing statement. That's the net section. A more, perhaps, significant assertion in this cross-point is that somehow the proceeds derived from the sale of the buildings 2 and 3 by the receiver were apparently not properly applied or proper credit not given it for. And at the risk of complicating perhaps an already complicated situation, I feel maybe a little bit of history of this transaction would help enlighten the court. When this series of transactions had its inception, Mr. Haney and Mr. Cannon, the defendants here, bought 3 separate tracts of land in Lufkin, and paying or committing themselves to pay approximately $75,000 for those tracts of land. Within a short while thereafter, a corporation called Huntsville Gateway Corporation borrowed $225,000 from the Lufkin National Bank, and this land was pledged as collateral. It was unimproved land. Almost a year after that loan was made from the Lufkin National Bank, if my memory serves, the first agreement was entered into between plaintiff and defendant for the construction of one condominium building consisting of 5 living units. As a part of that arrangement, this property was deeded to plaintiff, with the understanding that after the one building had been completed, plaintiff would be paid for the building and the land reconveyed back to the defendant. Well, that didn't work out. So then in August of 1977, They renegotiated the price on the first building that they would be paid to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff agreed to continue building buildings with the right to market units in the buildings as completed, with plaintiff to receive payment in full when each building was completed. Now, all the while, this Lufkin National Bank $225,000 note is in the background. It hasn't been paid. Interest is accruing on it, some of which is paid by plaintiff, some of which from time to time was paid by defendant, some of which was renewed into the note. Suffice it to say that after all five units in the first building were marketed by Duncan Development, approximately $31,000 was paid on that note at a time when it had a balance of something in the neighborhood of $255,000. It was reduced to about $220,000. That was the situation at the time the receivership sale occurred. Then, prior to the time of filing the suit, Duncan, the plaintiff, went down and pledged his property two buildings that were in process of construction in which he ultimately completed to Lufkin National Bank and borrowed $325,000 against those two buildings, which he had authority to do under the agreement. So you've got a $325,000 note owing to Lufkin National Bank, and you've got the land note. When the receiver sold the property, he paid the $391,000 net sale proceeds to the bank. The bank released its lien, served to pay off the interim loan that Mr. Duncan had obtained at the bank. And the balance was applied to the original note, original land note, leaving a balance on that original land note of $187,900. I realize I've talked a lot of numbers at the court. We prepared, in connection with this matter, a complete appendices to our brief in the Court of Civil Appeals, Appendix B, listing the figures we're talking about and referring in the statement of facts where the supporting documents and testimony relates to those figures. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We are in respondent.
The court with the argument of the
court. Court, please. The evidence I think we're concerned with is a Exhibit 5, famous Exhibit 5, which was an oral, which was a summary. That summary consisted of a manila folder containing four Xerox wiggle size pages. The first two pages were read from orally by Mr. Ray Carswell, the chief accountant of the petitioner, plaintiff. Those pages contained on page one, phase one, cost, a total figure, labor, a total figure, materials, a total figure, overhead, a total figure, profit, and then a total figure. And that is all. There was nothing else on that record. Over repeated objections in the record over a period of 5 days, the oral testimony was introduced concerning that summary. Now, I think it's important to keep in mind what we're dealing with here is a cost-plus contract. And I believe that we need to have a more stringent application of the business records statute 3737E than we would have in a lump sum contract. And that's particularly true where not only is the general contractor operating under a cost plus contract, but all of many subcontractors anywhere from 20 to 35 were also, with four exceptions, operating under cost-plus contract. What I understand the rules to require is reliability. The reason for the hearsay rule, as I understand it, is the lack of reliability of the hearsay evidence. The legislature, in establishing or codifying the shoplift rule under 3737E, required three categories of proof from a witness, a qualified witness, in order to overcome the hearsay objection. But I think what we get continually involved in is, my understanding is, there are two facets that need to be addressed in overcoming a summary of business records. First, we have the hearsay objection, and then secondly, we have a best evidence objection, because that summary is not the original record that we're looking for. My understanding is the cases have held that in order to overcome the best evidence rule for this type of testimony, first, the plaintiff petitioner has to establish that the record is voluminous. There may be some dispute in this record as to whether or not it was voluminous, because Mr. Carswell testified that there were two boxes of the invoices we're dealing with. But I think the court is justified in finding that that's voluminous. We have no quarrel with that. Secondly, they had to establish through that qualified witness that the records were either in court or made accessible or available to the defendant. And many pages of testimony that reveal that they made them accessible to them. They were in the record. There's no argument about that. But there's one particular facet of this rule which has been overlooked by petitioner, and that's this. The rule requires that summary has to be given by a qualified witness who has prepared that summary as a result of the review of the records himself, the underlying records. Mr. Carswell testified clearly that he did, at no place in his testimony did he ever even infer that he reviewed the underlying records, which we objected to being a hearsay. The summary was oral. Oral testimony read from an improper summary is inadmissible. Under this case is not in our brief. It's Holt versus Community Developers and Construction Company, 575 Southwest 2nd, 395 at 396. It's in the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals, a 1978 case, and the writ was refused, no writ of error.
Counsel, I'm looking at a summary that I didn't prepare of Black Lake. Did this court not set out some requirements there?
Yes.
And was this one of the requirements of Black Lake that you're talking about?
In Black Lake, there was a subcontractor and a general contractor. The general contractor, MPD, attempted to put the summary in the form of a letter. It was included in a demand letter written by their company. So in Black Lake, the objection there was the same as it is here. They were trying to overcome both the hearsay objection and the best evidence rule with the summary. And the court said that we have to, as the court has said in all three of the cases out of this court, Cooper Petroleum, Black Lake, and the University of Savings and Loan, all of those cases, it has been held that the statute says specifically, that witness who is qualified must show that this was done in the regular course of the business. It must be incident to that business. It has to be from personal knowledge of the person who made the entry, or he has to receive that information of that act or event or condition from somebody who had that personal knowledge and related it to him for entry in the record. And third, you have to show that it was made at or about the time of the act or event or reasonably soon thereafter. Now, this is what all of those cases hold. This is what was not done, and I'd like to point out to the court why it wasn't done. They called two witnesses, the General Superintendent Leon Morris and the Chief Accountant Mr. Ray Carswell. Mr. Carswell gave an oral summary that I previously described. What he gave was not a business record. That summary was simply an isolated transaction, the same thing that occurred in the case out of Galveston back in 1957, and when the court said clearly, and that was NRE, the court said clearly that an isolated transaction is not a business record and has never been admissible in evidence in this state, even under the old Shuffles rules, and much less under 3737E. He admitted that that thing was made in preparation for trial. Now, it was not prepared from his examination of the underlying record. He admitted that. He never testified to the contrary. It met none of the requirements of 3737E, the hearsay objection. All of the time in his testimony was spent on the best evidence ruling, not on the hearsay objection, which is to be overcome by 3737E. And it has to be kept in mind again, I can't stress enough that the problem with the cost plus contract, because in this case, this wasn't just a small part of the record that they were introducing. This involved, according to Mr. Carswell, one-third of the prices they were trying to charge him. Now, the way we tried to handle the objection was to present to the trial court, trial judge, with copies of the Blacklake case and the Avco case. And he allowed opposing counsel to read those cases and we discussed them thoroughly. The Avco case is pointed to by petitioner in this case as being in point to allow these things to be entered. But there's a very, very distinct fact difference. In our case, Mr. Leon Morris, the general superintendent, said that I was not on the job all the time. My practice, our policy, was to visit the job once a day, or in bigger jobs, sometimes twice a day. But in AFCO, the reason the court said specifically that they were admitting these documents and saying they were reliable is because the bookkeeper, Mrs. Peel, for the company, the originator of the record, he testified that the general superintendent was on the job all the time, all day long, made records and then turned them over to her for conclusion. So then we look at what did the subcontractors actually submit.
Counsel, before you get to that now, I'm having a little difficulty on just what it is that was lacking here. We have Carswell on the witness stand, and he's testifying that there's practice in the company. And then, am I hearing you say that because Carswell did not know about each, personally know about each one of the invoices, and whether that work was performed, that it's therefore inadmissible?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that he first has to be qualified as having reviewed the records, which he didn't testify to. He didn't say that he did that at all.
He has to go through all those boxes himself?
That's my understanding of the law.
Was this in Blacklake?
Well, that particular statement was not in Blacklake. That was a hearsay problem in Blacklake, and this requirement that the summary be by a qualified witness who has reviewed the records himself, the underlying records himself, is the best evidence problem, and not the hearsay problem. See, we have both the hearsay problem and the best evidence problem in a summary. If we have only a business record...
Well, we got an 80-story building going up in Houston. We got a cost-plus problem.
Right.
I'm accounting got to do with all those job tickets for 3 years, all the building up there.
Well,
is that fair?
No, that's not my suggestion at all. That's what the court would have.
I was asking if we had said that in Blacklake, and I'm saying...
No, we have not said it, but that problem wasn't addressed in Blacklake.
In other words, it's just testimony that the witness who is on the witness stand cannot testify about this mountain of invoices unless he has examined each invoice.
What I'm saying here is, as a practical matter, we have one-third of our billing coming from a third party. and no witnesses called to verify the reliability of those invoices from the subcontractors. Had they had somebody to verify that those invoices were accurate, then Mr. Carswell could have summarized it.
Well, now, I understood counsel to explain, and I thought this record shows that the invoices came in. It went across the desk of a person. That person then, as a practice, then they sent it out to determine whether the work billed on that invoice had been performed, and it came back tagged assigned it to a particular part of the job.
Now, what came in, Your Honor, was they had bids from only four contractors out of from 20 to 35 subcontractors. The subcontractors, according to Mr. Carswell, submitted, or Mr. Morris, Mr. Carswell didn't testify about this problem. Mr. Morris, the general superintendent, said that the subcontractors didn't send their bills in at or about the time of the work done, or reasonably soon thereafter. He said in many cases, they were prepared and sent in after the project was completed. So that doesn't meet 3737E requirement. But when they came in any event, into the general contractor's bookkeeping office, or into their offices, all they had on them was a lump sum price. They were not broken down in any way according to, based on man hours, days worked, or none of the details that were required, that were presented in the university savings and loan case, so that nobody who had personal knowledge of anything that the subcontractors did either testified or verified anything.
Now, if I understand that, then what we're saying is A is the general contractor.
Yes.
And B is one of 35 subcontractors out here.
Yes, sir.
B sends in an invoice.
Right.
And what you're saying is that A cannot testify under the Business Record Act unless he calls in a witness from the subcontractor,
or
B, and gets him on the witness stand to prove the validity of the subcontractor's business.
Right, and there's a case that says specifically.
All right, now that subcontractor, though, has contracted to build cabinets for a 20-story building. And that subcontractor, in turn, has sublet it to another subcontractor to do the hardware work on. So then the general contractor, in order to prove his case, would have to go down to the subcontractor and the sub-sub and put them on the witness stand to testify as to their personal knowledge or their practice. Is that what I'm understanding?
But there's a practical way to overcome this problem. Several practical ways. First of all, you do what they did in ASCO. You have somebody on the job.
That comes pretty close to a reversion to the chalkbook rule, where you've got to call in the original declarant.
Your Honor, it's either that, or we have to rely on a lump sum price in a cost-plus contract, when we have no basis for determining what went into it, the number of hours that went into it.
Well, if the records are available to you, that is a requirement.
But that doesn't help us any. My reviewing those records doesn't tell me any more than what they attempted to give me in the courtroom.
Well, counsel, doesn't the Article 3737E kind of take care of that? Such lack of personal knowledge may be shown to affect the weight and credibility of the memorandum or record, but not its admissibility.
Well, if it has reliability and it's admissible, if it will overcome the hearsay rule, the problem is how can it be reliable if it's from some third party and they can't even testify that Mr. Morris wasn't even able to name the subcontractor?
Counsel, as I understand it, what is missing in here is someone who worked for the builder, general contractor, who had personal knowledge of each of these charges.
That's right, and this could have been proved up by affidavit under the statute.
Now, if Mr. Morris, or Mr. Carswell, I guess, chief accountant, he could testify to all this. He could testify as to the general procedures his company went through and prepared these invoices. He had knowledge of that, and had each of these invoices been prepared by someone or checked by someone with personal knowledge and got into bookkeeping, then Farswell could testify to the procedures, and that would make his miss.
That's right. As long as, but they did testify as to the procedures. And that's correct. They have to do that. And they have to show, and they had to show they were voluminous. They have to show they're accessible. But in addition, to put that summary in, they've got to show that those underlying records are reliable. And the way that they have to do that, somebody has to have personal knowledge. If you'll recall, in the Nollenberg case versus Steel Tank Construction Company, 600 Southwest 2nd, 347, a 1980 case out of Houston Court of Civil Appeals, that man bought a business, and he acquired all the business records of his predecessor. He brought a suit later and attempted to prove it up, and the government said, and he, first of all, he said he had no personal knowledge of how they kept their record. He had no personal knowledge of how the work was done or who did it or when it was done. And the court sustained an objection to it under the business records statute. He then got back on the stand later on and just went through the statutory drill. Did they have personal knowledge, the people that didn't? He said yes. And did they do it in the regular course of business? And he said yes. But he simply went through the statutory predicate wrote when he had no personal knowledge of that matter. Mr. Carswell attempted to do that, but he then admitted on cross-examination that he had no personal knowledge. Nobody attempted to testify that they knew what any of these subcontractors did. The only thing Mr. Morris testified to is the work was completed and a lump sum came in and we okayed it. Now we're paying on a cost-plus basis. If that type of testimony from the general contractor doesn't fit the statute, how can it possibly fit the statute when it's coming from double hearsay from the subcontractor?
Counsel, I'm not arguing with you. I'm trying to understand this case. Now, the building contractor comes in and goes through the routine and proves what the practice is, that these invoices or these bills come in. And this may be where I'm missing. But I understood that there was testimony in this record that when those bills came in, that it was the practice of this company then to check whether or not this work was done and these supplies were furnished.
That's right, Your Honor. That's what they said. But there's another problem with that. He said that he wasn't the only one who checked it, number one. But let's suppose they were checked. He said what we checked was that the work was done. For instance, there's the building there. They didn't have to tell us that the work was done. We could see that. And
well,
I had a lot of
more than that. You've got to testify that this truckload of materials went into the building. Not that the building was a wreck.
That's right, sir. But what he's saying about the subcontracting is, all he said was that I knew that the work that they were supposed to do was complete. And I saw the figure, and I felt it was a fair figure. It's not, but the invoices, unlike the University of Savings case, the reason the records were allowed by this court in that case, in the record, is for this reason. They were very detailed. All of the invoices that came in, first of all, were prepared by the originator, were prepared by the general contractor. Secondly, they were very detailed in showing the dates of the transaction, exactly what was done, the description of the materials, that they were prepared at or about at the time of the event as required in the rules, and they were very detailed. These records weren't. These invoices
were nothing. Then what this means is that the building contractor indeed must go back down to the subcontractor and bring his employees in to prove their practices.
Right, or the sample.
And for him to testify that these materials were used for the contract.
There would be three ways of doing it. You either have your own man on the job, as was done in Abco, And you watch the subcontractors just the way you do your own employees.
And then the subcontractor and the sub-sub. In other words, you've got to go all the way down until you find, I take it, that as long as you have subs out, that you've got to prove the 37, the Business Records Act, as to each one of these subs before you can get your invoice in.
That's right. That's what the rule provides, and that's what the statute says specifically. But let me say this, Your Honor. If this was a lump sum contract, I don't think we have any problem. We wouldn't need a breakdown. If they had gotten bids, and the contractor said they were done, the work was done, and we okayed it, and it fit the bid, I don't think there'd be any problem. But when it's cost plus, and we are having to pay those contractors, those subcontractors, we wouldn't accept the bill directly from that subcontractor without some kind of a breakdown. And let me point this out, which I haven't mentioned. Before this suit was filed, the record shows that we specifically requested a breakdown, and Mr. Carswell said I received that breakdown, and all I sent back was an invoice with a price. He didn't give us the breakdown we asked for.
Who wrote AFCO? Can you remember? Houston Court of Civil Appeals before I sent it, but I don't want to be sure something was too wrong. Sir?
Judge Preston.
Preston? It's a no-writ case, as I understand
it.
If I were you, I'd rely on it if that's the best I had. Is there any case by this court that says what AFCO
is? With regard to the man having to be on the job?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, I really believe that this court has repeatedly set down the same requirements under that statute, that the man must have personal knowledge.
Well, that's why I get back to Blacklight, because I remember that when we struggled so hard and so long with Blacklight, and I don't remember that being in Blacklight.
Well, can I ruffle through these things here just a second, John?
Yes.
In Blacklight, general contractor MPD, subcontractor was union, MPD, records were blown, 4 or 5 file trunks. Those records were made available to Black Lake, the defendant. The summary was a letter to Black Lake by the project manager, and in it he had a narrative summary of extra work. The project manager admitted no personal knowledge of the dates of the work, no knowledge of the work itself that was actually done, and the fatal defect was that the underlying records were not identified, were not described, and were not shown to be admissible under 3737E. They made no attempt to establish a predicate for admissibility of the underlying records, and that's what's happened here. Union, in that case, the subcontractor, had voluminous records. The record-keeping procedures were described. The summaries contained statements and opinions of the foreman and other union personnel. They were held hearsay. That was fatally defective, and they were not admissible. The court, page 95 of that opinion, said they should have offered testimony describing the extent of the work from people with personal knowledge. And I'd also like to point out in the Black Lake case, as in all but two cases that I've been able to find on this problem, both the Business Record Act and on summary, in every case, those records were prepared by the originator of the summary, by the general contractor, the originator of the summary. There's only two cases in which they came from other than the originator. In the Nollenberg case that I've already mentioned, in which the man was an assignee of those records, they were not admissible. And the only other case, I believe, was a case out of Galveston. I'm sorry, it's Corpus Christi. And it's the Valsing Christina Corporation versus Ryman Well Service, 512 Southwest 2nd 803. It's a 1974 case. I didn't find a written history on it. It was a CPA letter that came in for acknowledgement of the accuracy of the record. They simply checked the original, mailed it back to the CPA, and then in trial tried to introduce it by saying that their president had seen this letter And as in our case, at trial level, they took the position that once it came into their office from a subcontractor, it became their record. That they have waved a wand over it and made it an admissible record just because they received it into their office record. I don't think that's what the rule requires. There was a case called Hultquist versus Ring, which is the Galveston case, in which the court did not admit a business record. It's a 301 Southwest 2nd 303, 1957, and it writ was refused on that was refused NRE. A gentleman who is not a lawyer but was practicing law apparently made some handwritten notes concerning the devisee in a will, and then died. The will that was prepared mentioned the decedent's sister, Alma, A-L-M-A. His notes that they tried to introduce showed that the beneficiary should have been Elmer, the nephew. And the question there was whether these notes were admissible under the business records statute. And they said that the records failed to establish that they were made in the regular course of business, and that they were an incident of such business. And it said that records of isolated transactions are not shown to be regularly made in the course of business and have never been admissible. So there's been only three cases that I can find where these records have been admissible under the statute. And that's the Avco case. They were rejected in Black Lake by this court. They were rejected in Cooper by this court. And they were rejected in the University Savings and Loan. They were let in the University Savings and Loan, I'm sorry. And they were let in the Baylor Medical Center case. But in that case, again, in every case, it's the employee of the originator of the summary who prepared the record in the regular course of their business, and not an employee who hasn't even been identified from some third party. The proof, the summary that he read from was already in the record. When, on the last day of trial, the five-day evidentiary phase of the trial, 3 hours before the trial ended, 5 hours before it ended, they then brought in 8 boxes of records, put them in front of the bench, and said, "Mr. Duncan, is that the records that these other men had been testifying to?" And he said, "Yes." I made the objection that they were inadmissible because they were hearsay. Judge Wilson then sustained my objection. He said, "Those underlying records, which that summary is based on, are not admissible." And it should be presumed that they were not admissible. And if the underlying records are not admissible, then the summary is not admissible.
One other thing to tidy up. I understood counsel to say that you also introduced Exhibit 5.
But what I did was, I did, first of all, if it's hearsay, I can waive objections to prejudicial matters, jury arguments, irrelevant matters, immaterial matters, but I cannot bootstrap inadmissible or evidence of no probative force. I can't bootstrap it in any way to make it reliable. If it's unreliable, it's unreliable. And all I did was put that in the record to demonstrate in the record what this man was testifying from, that it was a summary based on inadmissible evidence. And the court, this court has held, even in Cooper, that even in the absence of an objection, that it's not admissible. It doesn't bootstrap it into a basis for that summary. I'm sorry, Your Honor, for running over my
head. I asked you a question, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. We're going to
take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand you.
Are we ready?
No, thank you, sir. Your Honor, members of the court, one of the arguments that presented by counsel here is that there be a more stringent application, as I understand it, of the business record exception to cost-plus jobs. really, the only time that cost is really a critical factor by way of proof is in a cost-plus job. There might be some notable exceptions, but as a general proposition, this is where that type of proof will be needed. Now, we feel that the testimony, fairly construed, of the witnesses for plaintiffs demonstrate that there was a regular business practice within plaintiff's organization whereby documentations that were received, either in the form of invoices, bills, whatever you want to call them, were to be checked by employees of plaintiffs to verify that those items had been received or that the work done was done or that material furnished prior to the payment of those invoices.
I think the court is some of my questions have been regarded as unfriendly. I'm just trying to figure out where we're going.
All right, sir.
Somebody has to have knowledge of the veracity of these invoices.
Yes.
Or did you just have to receive them?
Your Honor, according to the testimony, an employee within a plaintiff's organization was, depending on which department he worked in, had the responsibility of checking the invoices to see whether or not the material was furnished or the labor performed.
The court will have to write an opinion, as we usually do, and let's assume that the records are kept by some big out this telephone company, the hospital, a railroad who never keeps any records, as I understand. All their records are in a computer.
Yes.
They don't keep any knowledge where the box cars are, they just punch them in the computer. You put garbage in, you get garbage out.
I understand.
Okay, somebody in the organization sends in a thing, and somebody who doesn't know anything about it punches it in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
They say, okay, what kind of invoices have we got? Punch the computer and out it comes. Now, is that admissible?
Your Honor, if the individual who transmitted the information to the computer had personal knowledge of the event to which that invoice related, if that individual went out and checked to see whether that work was done or that material was received.
And if he didn't?
If he didn't, then I think that I think we have two separate situations here. If we have a business practice that requires, I think we've met our burden under the statute. If the employee was not doing his job, is that your question, sir?
No, I just want to know, in this big asset, nobody knows anything. Nobody brings it, get by, and you send it up to the computer room. Somebody who doesn't know anything else puts it in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on business records. And it's done right now. Nobody knows anything about it, but they just say, well, what do we got? Punch the computer and out comes.
Well, I would think as a prudent business practice, Your Honor, and under the statute, it would be incumbent upon the entity attempting to prove those records to show that somebody with personal knowledge approved that particular item for entry upon the records and that the approval thereof was correct at the time, and that this was a practice of the company. It doesn't have to go to calling each individual who has this responsibility to the witness stand. But I think that if a businessman establishes that this is his business practice, as we did here in this case, we also had additional testimony from the construction superintendent on statement of fact on page 131, that he said he was aware of everything that went on this job. He had personal knowledge of everything that went on this job. And that every bill came across his desk. And in one form or another, he approved Mr. Payne.
Just a hypothetical, probably expected me to be in the case. Let's say XYZ funds on building one, he sends bill, plumbing building one, $28,000. Now, is your testimony that would be sufficient as long as the general superintendent says, I know the plumbing was done in building one, I got an invoice, $28,000 for that plumbing, therefore I verified it correctly. Your testimony is that is sufficient.
It is my position, Your Honor, that it is sufficient, assuming that the invoice was in accordance with the agreed price.
What's the cost plus of being a free price?
Between a plumbing contractor and a subcontractor, it probably would, Your Honor.
Well, this can, I assume the subcontractor, plumbing contractor, is going to be sending your client's bill.
Yes, sir.
If he sent a bill, $28,000 plumbing on building one, and the general superintendent says there's plumbing in building one, does he have to check any further in order to induce it at 3737?
No, I don't believe he does, Your Honor, but I would again qualify that to say that that building superintendent, as in the case of our client, would verify that the price of that item was reasonable and was in accordance with their understanding with the plumbing subcontractor.
That all the personal knowledge he must have is that the plumbing was done, period.
Yes, sir.
As far as personal knowledge, it must be transmitted to whoever makes these records.
Mr. Caton mentioned, I think maybe it was a slip, that we were talking about only two boxes of records here. For purpose of clarification, those boxes of records were 8 boxes in total. The testimony of Mr. Carswell with regard to the records was predicated upon what the records demonstrated or showed in his examination of them, and I think we would be the first to admit that he did not review every invoice and review every time card or everything in those records in preparing that summary. He reviewed his records generally. It's a running record-keeping process on the cost of all jobs, which he reviewed and from which he prepared his summary.
Man who prepared the summary didn't list it all open.
Not one by one. I can't not represent that to the court that he did. Those were incorporated into what they call the journal entry, made at or near the time the invoices were processed. In
Mr. Caton also mentioned an element that the statute requires that the memorandum must have been made about the time of the receipt and the work was done. And Don says this memorandum was made much later for the purpose of the trial. Is that a problem?
The summary was made at a later date for purposes of the trial. Documentation upon which the summary was based was made at or near the time. In the context of Black Lake and LaGoria, I don't see that as a problem. In both of those cases, I think the primary fault of the tendered offer of records was that the person making a summary had to go to extraneous sources in order to prepare his summary. It wasn't just based on the record. I think in one case he had to talk to a job foreman to find out what some of the records meant. And in another case, there were appeared that opinions were expressed by people who weren't on the witness stand the person making the summary, and he incorporated those opinions in the summary. So we feel that we here have established a course of business dealing and that someone at or near the time the event occurs makes entries upon the record, albeit they may be invoices received from other sources. They're incorporated in our record. We have never contended that we may wave a magic wand over these records and they became ours. They became ours because we worked on them. We verified them. We checked them.
And you shed any black parts on what is at a given time? In this instance, I'm talking about what time period between the completion of the work and submission of the invoice are we talking about?
I don't recall the record in this case speaking to that, sir. I would presume if I may be permitted to extend out of the record at the time that those things are processed for payment, which is normally monthly. The invoice received, it's checked, and submitted for payment.
What would not be part of the burden to be able to add a near one of the records?
Well, that add or neither, Your Honor, is kind of hard to put in context. We receive an invoice, and the testimony is in the record that when we receive that invoice, an employee of our client is required to check the work that the invoice relates to, make sure it's done, and approve it for payment, and then it's submitted to bookkeeping for payment. I believe that meets the add or near requirement as that may be used.
You don't tie the add or near to whatever work stuff is. You tie it to when you submit the invoice, when you pay.
I would believe that to be correct, Your Honor. But by the same token, in this particular case, we have testimony from our construction superintendent that indicated that he's out on the job all the time and aware of what is going on these jobs. So he has a fair idea of what has transpired on the job even before the invoices are received. In conclusion, I would like to point out to the court that throughout this trial and these appeals, the number one contention of these defendants at the trial court level and the Court of Civil Appeals level has been that Mr. Cardwell, who testified, did not have personal knowledge of all of the events transpired with respect to the activities to which the record related. At no time has the correctness of our record been challenged. There was one instance where an invoice was found. It was also pointed out by Mr. Carville in the cross-examination that a correction had been taken care of that month before trial. They examined our records on four separate occasions. The records were available. They have faulted us, perhaps because our subcontractors' bills were not completely itemized as well as they would have liked them to be. But again, we're dealing with subcontractors. Here are people that are billing us. And no telling who they are dealing with as their subcontractors. We submitted sufficient that our employees verify as a general course of conduct of this business that work has been done, material received, and that verification by our employees is demonstrated on trial should be all that be required here for the people.
If it takes that person knowledge, work and material, how would you ever get a hospital director in a person in 30-day hospital?
Well, I think, Your Honor, here, and believe me, I'm no expert on the hospital records. I get out of kilter there, but I believe you'll find that most hospitals base their records on documentation that is transmitted and prepared at or time the event occurs. And that's ultimately incorporated in their records.
That's true. You have to mess them in the business office. You have no idea how
to get. That's right. You'd virtually have to call every employee in that hospital who performed any service or handled anything in there. Particular series in order to make it admissible if that's the case.
Well, couldn't you just see to do it? Testimony from someone in charge of those figures saying when this employee gave an aspirin to that patient, put it on the chart, the chart was farted up. I wonder if he gave the aspirin had actual knowledge.
If you're talking about an estimate, Your Honor?
No. About the act performed at the time. Medicine was given, bandage changed, bedpan emptied, whatever it was, noted on the record. Someone who had actual knowledge that it's done.
And that's...
It's on the court.
I believe under those circumstances that would be admissible.
Well, you know. Now suppose that the doctor or the hospital tried to pay that bill just a little. How is making your records available to a patient from a hip?
Well,
what's the reliability of it?
If the records are made available to the patient, and the patient has some question as to the reasonableness of the charge.
I just got my mother out of the hospital. All I got is you just neck it. You just say, okay, give up. Go borrow the money. That's all you do. Why is that reliable?
Well, I don't know that the pure bill is reliable in and of itself, but if you go back and provide the records that substantiate the bill, then I'd say if those are provided to you, that gives you a basis at least for saying, well, this charge is unreasonable, or this service wasn't performed.
If either of you has cited any cases starting your brief, would you please let us have it by letter when you return home, please? Something that you speak and cite in case of anonymous.
Thank you.
Thanks. Case is submitted on written brief and oral arguments for both parties. You excuse the counsel, please.